Most people, especially Winslade, still considered my familiarity with her to be improper. She came out of her inner sanctum a moment later with her hair still hanging limp and wet. She had clothes on, but they didn't amount to a regulation uniform. She wore something like a sleeping jumper with rank insignia on the epaulets. It was the sort of thing officers wore to bed, but as usual it was tighter than it was supposed to be. Smart clothes could be told to cinch up if you wanted them to. Is this your off-duty shift, sir? I asked.
Unfortunately, high-level officers are never truly off-duty. Your visit is a clear exemplification of that reality. Now, before you waste any more of my time, get to the point. Why are you working so hard to see me in person?
Because I think you're making a mistake. I think you should check out all three of the systems where our enemy might have taken refuge as we originally planned.
The Raiders, of course. James, I know of your personal loss in this tragedy. I, too, would like to hold the Raiders accountable. But I have to be honest with you. We've lost them.
I blinked at her in surprise. That's not how I understand the situation.
We had one chance, really. That first stop. After that, the odds that we're still following the right course have grown very long indeed.
But the text did the math, I objected. This heading should match that of the Raiders. They have to come out eventually.
Let's assume you're correct,
she said, toweling off her hair while I watched.
We may have been going in the right direction initially, but we must admit to certain realities. Any Raider with a modicum of intelligence should have used the last few weeks to come out of warp, switch courses, and fly in another direction. They could have done that a week ago, for example, and we would never have known, as we were in a warp bubble ourselves and thus blinded. They could be doing it right now, in fact, and again, we'd never know.
I understand that, but a ship's crew will normally take a straight path toward their destination while fleeing. We had three target stars they might have been trying to—
Not really. We never had three targets. That first one held promise. The odds were high, we'd catch them there. But now the probability is slim. It's simple mathematics. We drew a line following their initial path as best we could, but our measurements couldn't be exact. Therefore, each light year we fly from the original starting point creates a cone of space, not a line, containing places they might stop. We're reaching the wide end of that cone, and there are a great number of destinations within it, so as I explained, that first binary system was our only real hope.
I felt a wave of frustration. She might be right, and in fact I sensed that at least she believed she was, but I didn't want to give up, not yet. You're talking about the margin of error, I said, about probabilities. Well, if it's hopeless, why aren't we abandoning the hunt right now? Why not simply turn around and go home today?
Politics and public relations forbid it,
she said, setting aside her towel and walking languidly around her desk to my side of it. She put her butt up against the edge of the desktop and leaned back, resting her hands on the desk.
We must make it seem we've searched everywhere to satisfy the angry mob back home. We're going to return empty-handed in the end, and it would be best that we take our time before we admit failure.
Look, I said, Imperator, we have a lot of secrets between us and quite a colorful past.
You think I'm going to listen to threats?
She demanded, interrupting.
Really, McGill? I hadn't thought you were so deluded as to think you could damage me at this point. I know about your little talk with Nagata. Don't think I'll be taken unaware.
Internally, I was shocked, but I didn't show it. Equestrian Nagata had charged me with feeding him information on Turov. He wanted her taken out of the upper brass, presumably because she was after his job. I'm not making any threats, I said carefully. I'm asking for a favor.
A favor? What gives you the right to ask for such a thing?
We owe each other a great deal. All I'm asking for this time around is a break. If you're going to stop searching after one more star anyway, make it the one we're passing by now. You said yourself the probability they'll switch course on us is growing every day. This binary system is inside the cone where they might make that move. Let's not skip it.
That would make you happy?
I wouldn't say that. I'm only going to be happy if we find them.
That, I believe,
she said, looking up at me thoughtfully.
What's in this arrangement for me?
I tried hard to think of something, but initially I drew a blank. You mentioned Nagata, I said at last. Maybe I could keep you informed on his actions instead of the other way around. This made her eyebrows rise high. She nodded appreciatively, taking her butt off her desk and approaching me.
I like the sound of that, she said. The best agents are double agents. You'll do that for me? Risk everything to feed me information about the witch hunt my enemies are engaged in back at Central?
If it will make you stop this ship, then yes. She turned away as if considering her options. My eyes wandered, as I was sure she knew they would. They fixated upon her hindquarters almost immediately, which were tightly packed into her thin jumper. She glanced over her shoulder and caught me looking. She smiled.
I accept your offer, James. You will make regular visits to my office. You'll report 3 times a week, every other day. Do you understand?
I said, looking down at her face and trying not to look even farther down. Not entirely. What am I going to report on? Nagata is back on Earth. She rolled her eyes and sighed. She reached back, grabbed my hand, and put it on her rump.
Are we clear now?
She asked. Oh, yes, sir. I was surprised, but I got over that very quickly. I stepped forward and began pawing at her. She leaned over her desk, and I removed what she had on, which didn't amount to much more than an ounce of sheer smart cloth anyway. We made love, then, right on her desk. I really hoped she had good soundproofing installed on her office walls, because she wasn't quiet about it. One more thing, sir, I said when we were finished. Can I call you Galena? She thought about it for a moment, frowning.
No, I'd prefer you didn't.
Very well, sir. I left after that, and I have to confess, I was smiling. One could say I'd been abused by my superior, sexually coerced even. But then again, one could say that I didn't mind the abuse. Not one bit. Chapter 8. We stopped at the binary star system the next day. For some reason, I wasn't as keyed up this time around as I'd been on the first stop. Whether that was because I'd given up on finding the raiders or because I'd had a chance to blow off some steam, it was hard to say. Leeson came to check up on me while I donned my battle armor. He put his hands on his hips and put a crooked grin on his face. When he spoke, his voice was low, rumbly, and amused.
You sly dog, you, he exclaimed. I heard about Turov. What I can't believe is you managed to halt an entire expedition in deep space with a single office visit.
I glanced at him and fooled with my helmet straps. Whatever you heard, sir, was exaggerated gossip. I will admit that the Imperata have seen the light and reconsidered her options. I presented my case and she made the call. Rumors that I went farther than that to change her mind. Well, that's sheer speculation.
You just marched up there to Gold Deck and did a little persuading, eh?
Leeson said, chuckling and leering at me.
What do I have to do to get a ticket to a lady's office on Gold Deck?
Snorting, I shook my head. I'd recommend taking up that question with her personal staff. She has one adjunct that's particularly accommodating. Her name's Bakchan. Leeson nodded thoughtfully.
Adjunct Bakchan, huh? I might just look her up. Thanks for the steer, McGill.
No charge, sir.
I watched him leave with a hint of a smile on my face. I truly hoped he did approach and proposition Adjunct Vachon. She'd probably tear him up. The target system didn't have a lot of planets, but there were some that were worth investigating. We came out of warp near the M-class star and cruised by her handful of dimly lit planets in the first hours. Then we turned the bow around and pointed it toward the K-class and glided in that direction. More waiting followed. I felt stressed and ordered my squad to stand down. It would be nearly a full day's cycle before we reached sensor range for the bigger star. I was anticipating failure. My mind was churning. I'd sold my soul to Turov already. How could I get her to continue the hunt when this system proved fruitless? In retrospect, I was wishing I'd held something back to bargain with. I needed to keep this search going, and I was running out of both options and time. That night, I lay in my bunk, stewing over my situation. I couldn't sleep. In the morning, we'd arrive at the K-class and either discover the enemy raiders or, more likely, nothing at all. Then I'd be right back where I started. How could I get Turov to fly to the next star? And if I managed that, what if the third one was as empty as the first two? What was I willing to do to get the Imperator to press on? At about 1 a.m. I finally sprang out of bed, wide awake. I paced for a time like a caged tiger, then threw on some clothes and headed out into the passages. The ship was quiet, but not dark. The night shift of Skrull crewmen were pacing the halls and keeping everything running. They glanced at me as I passed by, but I said nothing. It wasn't their job to question the humans, who they thought were crazy anyway. They flew the ship, that's all. Sometimes I envied the spidery little aliens. Adjunct Vachon intercepted me as she'd done the day before. To my surprise, she was still on duty in the middle of the night. Maybe intercepting people who were coming to see Turov was all she did. This time, however, she didn't sneer at me. She frowned and looked suspicious, but there was no more sneering.
"This way, veteran,"
she said in an almost mechanical voice. I followed her, not bothering to ask questions. She'd clearly been briefed and ordered to let me pass. She didn't seem happy about that, but she wasn't openly complaining. When the door to Turov's office opened, I found the Imperator to be absent.
"Wait here,"
Vachon said. I nodded and did as she instructed. A few minutes later, Turov arrived. Again, I was surprised. She wasn't yawning and wearing a nightie, quite the opposite. She was fully dressed and seemed stressed.
"What do you want now?"
she snapped.
"Haven't you done enough?"
"What are you talking about, sir?"
"The K-class,"
she said, but then she broke off. Her eyes narrowed. She walked up to me and stabbed a finger into my chest.
"You knew, didn't you?"
Knew what, sir?
"Again with the dumb act. It won't work, McGill, not this time. And to think I believed I was manipulating you. What I don't understand is how you could have known. But you must have. You were emphatic about stopping here, suggesting we skip the last system in the line. Did you imagine I wouldn't remember the details?"
As often happened when conversing with officers, particularly Turov and Winslade, I felt I was being imbued with powers I simply didn't have. The question in my mind now was how to deal with this situation. My first instinct was to play dumb, because that's exactly what I was. I had no idea what she was talking about, including why she was claiming I'd managed to trick her somehow. But I didn't want to play dumb. I was desperate, and I needed leverage. She could stop this mission at any time. But I knew that if she thought I was some kind of wizard, my odds of keeping things going improved. Therefore, I chose to pretend I had the upper hand. "I'm often underestimated, sir," I said, giving her a confident smile. Her lips pouted, and she made a hissing sound as she brushed past me. She moved to her desk and swept her arm across it, casting a dozen scrolls and a fold-up monitor onto the floor. The desk turned into a screen and displayed local space.
"There,"
she said, stabbing near the center of the system.
This K-class star has only a single inner planet. Mysteriously, life has been detected on its surface.
She looked back at me accusingly, as if daring me to confess to a crime. I looked back in bewilderment.
Okay, I said. There's life, but there's plenty of life on different worlds. What's the big deal?
We checked the catalogs, and this system was scanned and deemed empty centuries ago by the Galactics. How do you explain this discrepancy?
I said thoughtfully, stepping closer to the display. Looking at the planet, it doesn't seem remarkable. It's in the Goldilocks zone, circling a stable star. It's rocky, and although it's a little smaller than Earth, it appears to have an atmosphere and liquid water.
I know all that, she snapped. The point is, it was listed as uninhabited and uninhabitable. Why? There are life readings down there. And that's why you led me here, isn't it? To find a world that shouldn't be? A secret living planet?
I shrugged because I was pretty close to being out of ideas. Sometimes it's best to let imaginative people run with the ball for you. She stared at me and made growling sounds. I could tell she was thinking hard.
You've given me provocative hints, she said. I'm putting the pieces together. The only way this planet could be here is if someone altered the data. Someone must have hidden this world by deleting or changing the records. That means one of two things, involvement by the Galactics or some kind of criminal element.
I find it highly unlikely that the Galactics would bother to do this to themselves. The Nabs would have a fit if they found out.
Right, she replied intensely. It can only be a conspiracy, a purposeful error in the local star surveys. In any case, it doesn't matter. The criminals we seek must be here, waiting for us.
Well, then let's go nail them, I boomed.
She stared at me with hooded eyes.
Are you leading me into some kind of trap? This smells like one of Claver's schemes to me.
Claver was back on Earth the last I knew, sir.
She looked at me oddly for a moment, and I had to wonder if she knew where Claver really was. Then she made a dismissive gesture, erasing my words with her hand.
Regardless of where Claver might be, she said, I know you two are working for Nagata. Don't bother to deny it.
Imperata, let me assure you on one point. For the duration of this mission, I'll be working for you.
She bit her lower lip. She looked worried, and I could tell she wasn't sure who to believe in.
Let's go over recent events, she said at last. First, mysterious pirates show up over Earth and brazenly attack. Second, I'm sent out here to catch these pirates. But then third, when I deviate from the course recommended by Central, you do your best to dissuade me. Fourth, as if by divine intervention, the second star system you specified as the target turns out to be the correct one.
I watched the wheels turning in her head. I figured I had to say something. Heck, if I let her keep thinking on her own, she'd have me drawn and quartered by sunrise. Taking a half step toward her, I placed a hand on her elbow. I couldn't sleep, I said. That's why I'm really here. She shook off my touch.
Don't. Seduction won't work this time, McGill. You have to do better than that.
My mind was in a state of confusion. By my way of thinking, she'd seduced me the first time around. Actually, it had been that way every time around, if my memory served. But a man doesn't get far with the ladies if he doesn't back off when signaled to do so.
Sorry, sir, I said. Should I be returning to my squad? Should I prepare for action?
Her slitted, suspicious eyes studied me.
I wish I knew what was really going on inside your brain, McGill.
Sometimes, I said, I'm uncertain myself.
Dismissed. Get some sleep. We'll probably be in action within 20 hours. I'll make sure you're given a front-line seat when the fighting begins.
Thank you, sir. I'm looking forward to a shot at revenge. She watched me leave, and I could tell she wasn't sure how to take my reference to revenge. I'd hoped she'd feel that way. I knew it was always best to keep your opponent guessing. Chapter 9. It was precisely 11 hours later, down to the minute, when we finally spotted our quarry. They weren't trying to hide, not really. They'd taken some precautions, but nothing our techs couldn't penetrate. Their radio network, for example, was set up to emit low-power, diffuse transmissions, which looked like white noise, and the exhaust plumes of their ships weren't nearly as brilliant as those an Imperial ship might produce. But then that was because Empire ships had little to fear inside the borders of Frontier 921. These people were fugitives. They had plenty to worry about. Primus Winslade gave us our mission briefing personally. He explained that we were the designated shock troops who'd been hand-picked for the honor of being the first ones dropped on the newly discovered planet. I had to give Winslade a few points for style. He was making the best of the situation, one which I knew he couldn't be happy about.
"This is a rare opportunity," Winslade said, addressing the entire cohort from the forward wall of our respective unit modules. "We've lost our dragons due to the depredations of these criminals. Now it's time for payback. We'll drop, engage, and exterminate. We're Imperial troops with a clear mandate. These creatures, whoever they are, broke galactic law when they attacked Earth's freighter. At that moment, they all forfeited their lives."
Hearing these words, I frowned a little. Sure, I wanted to kill the culprits who attacked our planet and dropped burning metal bricks onto my family, but that didn't necessarily mean I was out to kill every alien on the world we were approaching. That would be like killing all the relatives of a murderer. Sure, the criminal deserved justice, but did his grandma have to die as well?
"As representatives of the Empire," Winslade continued, "you should feel no remorse in your hearts, no pity, no quarter. Remember, they gave none to our people when they attacked and disabled our freighter on its final approach. There were over 30,000 casualties within moments."
Still frowning, I tried not to shuffle my feet or say anything. It required a concentrated effort, but I managed it.
"Here's how the invasion will unfold. First, we'll launch a full strike with our broadsides. The enemy has a large base, which we've located by tracing their transmissions. That base will be destroyed. The landing will then commence, with this cohort leading the way. It will be our mission to mop up any remaining resistance."
A cheer went up from the unit. I smiled proudly. There wasn't a coward among them. A few were more cautious than the rest, but no one shirked from a good fight.
"There are possible caveats to be considered, however," Winslade continued. "Events may not unfold as we plan. We are unclear as to the enemy's precise strength. We might be facing a strong space defense, for example, before we reach the planet itself. So far, it appears, we have the element of surprise on our side. Imperator Turov elected to apply massive thrust with the smaller star to our stern, hiding our emission signature in the glare of the red sun. From the enemy's point of view, we probably look like an unusual solar flare."
I gave a tiny nod in appreciation of the strategy, although I doubted Turov herself had come up with it. She'd clearly had the foresight to recognize a good idea when she heard one, no matter who had thought it up. As was her nature, she'd probably order the tactic to be employed, then quickly took credit for it when she briefed her top officers.
"This ruse can't protect us forever, unfortunately," Winslade continued. "Cruising at high speeds, we're approaching the point at which we must slow down or slam into the target planet. After that moment, they may spot us and launch a counteroffensive."
You could have heard a pin drop after Winslade mentioned a counteroffensive. The troops had been all grim smiles and determination. But the idea that we might soon meet up with a defending enemy fleet, or at least a missile barrage, hadn't sunk in until now.
The last thing a ground pounder wants to encounter among the stars is a fleet battle. Under such circumstances, we were no more than spam in a can, as the old saying went.
"We'll know the truth within 8 hours," Winslade concluded. "Deceleration has already begun, and it will continue until we've reached the target. Everyone is to stay in full kit, ready to deploy when the word is given."
The briefing ended, and the wall of the module went dark. Afterward, Graves called his officers and top nomcoms to a meeting. Under our feet, the deck was heaving and shuddering. We felt about an extra half-gravity of weight on our bones. The inertial dampeners couldn't contain all the fantastic stresses that physics was applying to Minotaur as we went in to what amounted to a long, roaring skid toward the target world.
"Sounds like the brass has it pretty well in hand this time,"
Adjunct Leeson said, walking ahead of his veterans. I glanced at Veteran Harris, but he didn't say anything. He looked kind of glum, but that was all. Accordingly, I decided to give the adjunct what he expected. My natural skills with bullshit often come in handy when motivational statements were called for.
"Right you are, sir,"
I said loudly without a trace of doubt in my voice.
Not to be outdone, Harris sucked in a breath.
"The enemy are as good as dead, sir," he boomed. "They'll never know what hit them. Justice will be done. And this nest of thieves will be wiped out."
"Damn straight,"
agreed Leeson, without even looking over his shoulder. We hit the hatch with outstretched gauntlets, and it retreated from our touch. Graves was in his office. After all three of his adjuncts, plus Harris, Johnson, me, and a half-dozen other veterans filtered in, the room was a little cramped. We gathered around the desktop display. Graves was tapping at it, sliding icons around and projecting colorful arcs. The planet itself had a lavender-green cast to it. I wasn't sure if that was due to the atmosphere or the natural shade of the surface.
"This is it," Graves said, waving his hand over the map. "The planet is fractionally smaller than Earth, with a gravitational pull of about 0.8 Gs. It has a breathable atmosphere, and although it's hot, it isn't unbearably so."
He paused to run his eyes over each of us in turn.
"That's where the good news ends," he continued. "There's life here. Lots of it. We've got high oxygen levels, and as far as we can tell, the whole place is a massive forest. When I say massive, I don't just mean in extent, which is shore to shore on every continent. I'm talking about the growths themselves, which seem to be megaflora."
Frowning, I looked around the group. A few of the others looked concerned at the Centurion statement. Others, like me, had no idea what he was talking about. My hand went up almost before I knew I was raising it.
"What is it, McGill?"
"Sir, what exactly is megaflora?"
"Plants. I'm talking about huge plants,"
Graves replied.
"These trees or flowers or whatever they are, they're big, very big. We're talking bigger than the redwoods of Earth for the small ones."
He let that sink in. Adjunct Leeson raised a gauntlet next, and he asked the question I was pondering.
"Sir, are we talking about a thick forest canopy, and if so, how are we going to get through it and down onto the ground?"
Graves pointed a finger at him.
"Bingo, Leeson. We're going to have trouble. Two paths are open to us. The most obvious is to fly down in lifters and try to squeeze in between the growths with careful piloting. The other approach is simply to fire down everyone in capsules and hope some punch through to the ground and make it out alive."
No one replied. No one looked happy with either suggestion, but Graves didn't seem to notice.
"I like the pod drop approach myself," he said. "It's quicker, even if it is dangerous. On the other hand, using lifters risks a long hang time over the target, giving defensive batteries plenty of time to lock on and shoot us down."
Alarmed looks were exchanged. People frowned and massaged their chins. Both invasion approaches sounded like suicide to me, particularly the pod drop method. I didn't like the idea of coming down in a bullet-shaped capsule and slamming into a 1,000-meter-tall oak tree.
"Of course," Graves went on, A secondary concern when faced with a world loaded with megaflora is the possibility of megafauna to go with it. Some of you may be senior enough with the Legion to remember dropping at Barnard's Star. He looked around, but no one else appeared to recall that particular campaign. It had probably happened decades ago. No matter, Graves said. He smiled and chuckled in a rumbling fashion as if musing on a distant memory. That was a mess. We came down into a world full of marine life. The oceans weren't deep, only a mile or so, and the planet was dotted with islands. We'd heard about the big aquatic species, of course, but hadn't realized so many of them could come humping up onto land if they wanted to. Huge leviathans came after us the moment we landed. They gulped down recruits with an appetite that was almost insatiable. He shook his head and sighed. I was an adjunct back then. Those were the days. Anyway, we found only moderate methane levels, indicating there is animal life, but not necessarily huge animal life. The briefing went on, detailing our insertion plan. As Graves spoke, I began to grow an appreciation for the difficulty of our task. We simply didn't know what we would be facing. Normally, when an Earth Legion flew out on a mission, we at least came to the party with a solid conception of what we'd be facing, but not this time. This world wasn't even supposed to be here at all. The system was essentially unknown to us. We couldn't look it up in our databases. We had no maps, no data. And we didn't have much time, either. There was only a few hours to go, and we had to make crucial decisions before we reached the target. Graves made these difficult calls without a qualm. He gave us our orders after laying out his thin intel, his hopes, and his worries.
We're going to try a combination approach, he said in summary. We're part of Winslade's lucky cohort, so we're the guinea pigs. Half the cohort will be fired down into the canopy of this vast forest like a spray of bullets. The other half will glide down in lifters and try to penetrate the vegetation. In either case, we're to reach the surface any way we can. Depending on what happens to each group, the rest of the Legion will choose the better option for further drops.
I left the briefing with a slightly queasy feeling in my stomach. I told myself it wasn't fear, but, as I've said, I can be a terrible liar, even to myself. Chapter 10. As we made our final approach to the strangely overgrown planet, Imperator Turov couldn't resist the opportunity for one last speech while she had her captive audience intact. We were called to the module briefing area where our glorious leader was displayed on the far wall. The image had to be 30 feet high. Her dark eyes were a lovely almond-shaped, but they were disturbing at this level of magnification.
"Troops," she said, addressing all of us. "I have a treat for all of you. Justice."
The camera view switched to Minotaur's tactical control room. I'd been in that chamber before and noticed it hadn't changed much. There were two primary operators who both had to engage the firing system at the same time to arm the broadsides. As we watched, they checked the final targeting data and gave our hovering camera drone the thumbs up.
"We've located a source of emissions on the planet's surface which doesn't match any natural patterns," Turov said on voiceover as we watched the gunners work their equipment. "We've picked up radio transmissions, heat, and other energy release readings. This region on the southern coast of the central continent must contain their base."
The camera shifted to an external view. We watched as the massive broadsides smoothly traversed and zeroed in. The big guns didn't look like they were aiming right at the planet. But when you're throwing fusion shells over 1,000,000 kilometers, you had to take gravitational effects into account as everything began to curve.
"Locked on,"
Turov's voice announced. A yellow circular firing reticle lit up on the planet.
We were indeed aiming at the southern coast of the largest central continent. Shrouded in clouds and covered in purplish-green vegetation, the continent was a big piece of land, maybe the size of Asia.
And now, I'll clue in our criminal friends concerning our intentions. They will bear witness to their punishment, even as we mete it out.
A red box lit up on the screen, and the word transmitting appeared.
Alien criminals,
Turov announced in an officious voice.
We have come to deliver justice to this world. Whether you know it or not, you're within the boundaries of the Galactic Empire. We are local enforcers in this province. We will now annihilate you in recompense for your attack upon local shipping.
We all watched, fascinated. Turov's speech was making it more suspenseful, I had to admit. I wasn't feeling any remorse for the enemy. This was their base. With any luck, the enemy raiding ship that had killed so many back home would be down there. We'd blast them all dead in one shot.
We're broadcasting this announcement to you, using every known form of communication,
Turov continued talking to the unknown aliens,
including that of the Cephalopod Kingdom, just in case you're allied with them. Let it be known that we do not take this action for reasons of anger and revenge. We are merely applying the strict rule of galactic law to creatures that...
Something happened then, and Turov stumbled in her speech. The screen, which depicted the planet as seen from our zoomed-in targeting systems, changed. It was a subtle change at first. A glimmer of shiny green appeared, not just at one spot, but at a dozen of them all at once. They were objects, unknown ovoid contacts, appearing between Minotaur and the target world.
What the hell are those things?
Carlos asked aloud. I was his superior, and I should have cuffed him one, telling him to shut up during our top officer's speech. But I didn't. I was too dumbstruck and confused to do much of anything.
I see there is a response,
Turov said, regaining her composure.
Crew, take defensive action. It will make no difference how they try to squirm away from their fate.
Turov had always been long-winded. There had been more than one occasion in our storied adventures together during which I'd wished she'd get on with the show. This time, like so many others, she decided to keep on talking.
As I was saying, we take this action to correct a grave wrong inflicted upon us. After enduring your punishment, from which there is no escape, you must submit to the Empire and hope that they will be merciful. When the Nair prefects eventually come here to see that justice is exercised properly, it's possible those of you who have survived this day will be spared. I make no promises, but with appropriate supplication and an attitude of servile...
The green things, which were shiny and kind of egg-shaped, took action again. Instead of hanging around Minotaur, they plunged toward it. Intercepting fire from a dozen point defense cannons blazed orange sparks out from our dreadnought to meet these incoming green eggs. They popped and burned, but more and more appeared behind them.
We're under attack,
Turov said irritably. I could tell she was annoyed that the enemy had managed to cut off her speech, which was just winding up to its climax. When she spoke again, her words came out a little more quickly.
In conclusion, I say this to those who are about to be crushed. You're on the wrong track. The road to total destruction is paved by resistance. You will learn this lesson now. Weaponeers, fire the broadsides!
The view from outside the ship disappeared as the blast shields rolled into place and clammed shut. Then, the broadsides spoke at last. Having been aboard dreadnoughts before when they unleashed the power of their primary weapons, I knew to brace myself. The deck bucked up with the tremendous release of energy. Plenty of my fellow troops either hadn't known what to expect, or they'd forgotten. People were knocked to their knees or even onto their faces.
The ship's stabilizers fought to keep the vessel on an even keel, and after shuddering with sickening aftershocks, the automated systems seemed to manage the task. But the shivering didn't subside completely. The ship was still rolling a little, quivering. It was as if we were releasing smaller projectiles, or...
"Those green pods," Carlo said, climbing back to his feet. "They're hitting us, right now, landing on the hull."
He was right. He had to be. "Visors down," I roared to my confused troops as they picked themselves up off the deck. "Weapons locked and loaded."
"Listen up," Graves said in my helmet.
He'd engaged the unit-wide channel so I didn't have to relay his instructions.
"We've been hit by unknown objects. They're sticking to the hull. We don't know anything more, but in case this is a boarding attempt, we're to report to the rim outside Blue Deck."
The rim was a region between two heavy hulls. The inner hull of the ship had an empty pocket between it and the outer skin. I hadn't spent much time in that region of the ship, except for a few training drills, but I was game for something new today.
"Stay together, squad," I ordered. "Follow me."
Rifles in our hands, we clanked for the exit. On the big forward screen, I caught a final glimpse of Galina Turov. She looked pissed off, and maybe, just maybe, a tiny bit scared. Her haughty pronouncement of doom had been transformed into a battle by an enemy who appeared to be more cunning than she'd thought. I wasn't any happier about that than she was. As I trotted through passages full of yellow flashers and blaring alarms, I couldn't help but wonder how this was going to go down. After all, it seemed to me that this enemy, whoever they were, had been at least one jump ahead of us every step of the way. They'd shown up in our skies back on Earth, stolen part of a vital cargo from an Earth freighter, and managed to send the freighter crashing down into the middle of two assembled legions. Today, what had appeared to be a desperate attempt to escape our fleet had instead transformed into a trap to ensnare us. The knowledge that our broadsides had already fired on them gave me some solace, however. The enemy may have miscalculated on that score. Those shells were arcing toward their base, and as far as I knew, they were unstoppable.
"That had to be the dumbest thing I've ever seen Turov do," Carlo said inside my headset on a private channel, "and I've seen them all."
I didn't really have time to talk to Carlos, but he had me curious with that statement.
"What do you mean, Specialist?"
Carlos was my squad's resident medic on this mission. A bio-specialist of the lowest grade, he'd been assigned to our combat unit to patch us up. On the surface of things, that sounded logical enough. He had good fighting skills, and I was pretty sure they'd tested him and determined that he would suck at any other function a bio normally performed. I couldn't easily imagine him running the revival machines, performing surgery, or even providing long-term care for the moderately wounded. Because of this, embedding him in a combat unit as a medic seemed to be a no-brainer, but I had my reservations. I didn't relish being patched up by my old friend, despite his new stripes and training. All that said, I still wanted to know what he was thinking about Turov.
"I mean that she broadcast some long speech at the aliens instead of just firing on them," he explained. "That was a mistake. Maybe they didn't even know we were hostile. Maybe they weren't sure we were in space. We probably had the element of surprise going in, but no. She had to go and make a speech and blow all that."
"You might be right," I admitted. "But what's done is done. We have orders. Let's follow them." I cut off his channel and opened my squad chat.
"All right, listen up. I want everyone looking sharp when we come through this hatch into the rim. Remember that there's no pressure in there. Not much in the way of gravity, either. Turn on your magnetics and keep buttoned up. Look around for anything like a breach and sound off if you see anything."
We reached the hatch, and I opened it after taking a breath. A whoosh of escaping gas rushed past me like a small storm. There was an airlock, but it wasn't an efficient one with pumps and pressure equalizers. All it did was limit the amount of air it farted out when you opened the side that led into vacuum. We rushed into the airlock and sealed the hatch behind us. The whole squad fit, just barely. Harris's squad was next in line to go through, and they watched us with grim expressions and tight grips on their weapons. We swung the second, massive hatch open, which released a gush of air into the rim between the hulls. In between the two hulls were the ribs of the ship. These titanium bones ran beyond the limits of our sight above and below us. Each rib wrapped around the belly of the ship. They were huge, imposing, and curved with the ship's contours.
"Tactics vet?" Sargon asked me. "With my belcher, I mean? Use your weapon as you see fit, weaponeer," I said. "This area is kind of tight. Only about 10 meters between the hulls, with lots of structural girders and the like. We'll be on patrol, but you never know when you'll run into a surprise."
I saw him cranking his weapon aperture to a medium setting. I approved. It's what I would have done. Widening the muzzle a bit turned his weapon into a shotgun rather than a rifle, but without making it as broad and uncontrollable as a fire hose. I'd spent years as a weaponeer myself, and when I didn't know what I was going to be aiming at in a tight space, I broadened the scope so I would at least make sure I didn't miss. Off toward the stern was another knot of troops. My HUD told me it was the 3rd squad from my platoon. Adjunct Leeson had seen fit to fight with them instead of with me, and that was just fine in my book. Sometimes an officer in your midst on a patrol mission could be more of a hindrance than a help. We moved as a squad to the location that Graves had pinpointed on my tactical display. The position was depicted both inside my helmet and on my tapper. When we reached our post, we dispersed, taking what cover we could, and latched our clamps and cords onto the girders. Then, we waited. The waiting was far from peaceful. The ship often vented gases into the rim, blasts of unknown origin that equalized pressure from inside the ship into this no-man's land in between the hulls. The ship also lurched and wallowed at random intervals. I knew the pilots were trying to maneuver and avoid danger. I could only hope they were being successful.
"Unit," Graves said several long minutes later, "we've got word from Goldtech. We're to expect boarders. Repeat, the hull is being breached in a dozen spots. At first, they clustered their attempts to penetrate near the jacket that encircles the engine core. That was too thick for them, apparently, and they've shifted tactics. They're now attempting entry all over the outer hull looking for the thin spots. It won't be hard for them to find a weak point."
A single question was burning in my mind, and I took this opportunity to ask it.
"How are they getting in, sir? How can they drill through even a single meter of titanium that fast?"
"They aren't drilling," he said. "The word is, they're using concentrated acid. The shielding around the core was dense and full of lead, but the rest of the skin is relatively thin. The acid is eating holes in Minotaur, like a hot flame applied to wax."
Acid? I gave my head a shake. The enemy had an acid that ate metal like nothing? How had they gotten it up here in sufficient quantities? And what were those shiny green egg things anyway? Pods full of acid?
There weren't any answers forthcoming, but we were about to have company. Even as I cradled my rifle and tried to look everywhere at once, Keevy shouted behind me. I craned my neck and levered myself around to see where she was pointing.
"There it is," I shouted. "We've got a breach. Centurion Graves, we've got a breach. I see liquid running inside the hull near my position. It looks like the titanium is dissolving into bubbling, smoking mercury."
"Keep your head straight, McGill," Graves replied. "We've got reported breaches in a half dozen spots. Hold your position and repel the enemy. Graves out."
Chapter 11. All our questions about what we were facing answered themselves over the next few minutes. Because the ship rotated to provide simulated gravity through centrifugal force, we were standing on the inside of the outer hull. Melting metal bubbled up under our feet. The enemy burned their way into the ship as we watched, and we soon learned it was best to stand well clear of any breach we spotted. When the acid came through, it produced a vapor that looked poisonous. I was glad I had my visor clamped down. If the zone had been fully pressurized and my visor was open, the gas might have killed me. It spread quickly due to the low pressure inside the rim and soon formed a fog that filled the entirety of my visual range.
If a spot starts to bubble under your feet, get out of the way,
I needlessly instructed my squad. They were already climbing the girders and hanging there like nervous monkeys in trees. There were two regions bubbling before the first one burst and showered droplets of molten metal everywhere. A few of my troops were in the splash zone. Curses erupted immediately. Sargon, unfortunately, was one of the troops showered with droplets.
I caught a few, vet, he reported. Bad luck, I guess.
Bad luck, I agreed, eyeing him. His kit was smoking. We were wearing armor that was pretty thick, but not as thick as the ship's hull. How long could he hold out before it ate through to his flesh?
Sargon, I want you to retreat to the airlock, I said. Get out of that armor and get a new suit issued by the Tex.
Vet, I'm good, really, he said. I think the effect is dissipating. This armor is layered with polymers, not just metal. Maybe the acid can't...
That was as far as he got before the patch of the hull that had turned into a stewing, smoking mess popped completely open. We were well back from it by then, and no one was hit by the splash this time, but that didn't mean we weren't in danger. A dark, greenish shape wriggled through the liquid metal. It was smoking and probably hissing, but we couldn't hear that through our thick helmets in the near vacuum. The shape loomed up until it was taller than a man, and just for a second I thought I saw something that resembled a misshapen head. Beads of metal ran from it like thick sweat. A gush of energy was released by our side a fraction of a second later. Sargon had fried it, whatever it was. Fortunately, although these things were able to melt metal and wriggle through a bubbling mass of acid, a bolt of plasma burned them just fine. The thing shuddered and thrashed, but Sargon kept the trigger down on his belcher for a full second. Converted largely to ash, the invader slumped and stopped moving.
"Holy shit!" Carlos exclaimed. "What the hell was that thing?"
"There's another one!"
Kibi shouted. Sargon swung his belcher around, but it had yet to recycle and dissipate the heat buildup after such a long burn. We all unloaded our rifles on the second invader. Our new morph rifles were more powerful than those of light infantry. We'd configured them into their assault weapon form, increasing their rate of fire. At this range, any loss of accuracy didn't matter much. We hammered the second monster with accelerated explosive shells. Again, it demonstrated tremendous vitality by not dying right off. We must have put 200 pellets into the thing, blasting it apart before it stopped struggling. Approaching cautiously, Carlos poked at the mess with his rifle butt.
"Strangest damned critter I ever saw," I said, keeping my distance in case it wasn't quite dead.
Carlos squatted next to it.
"I just took xenobiology, and this thing is weird," he announced. "This isn't a normal creature of meat and bone. It could be some kind of construct. See these strands? They're cellulose, I'm sure of that much."
I was impressed not only by Carlos's newfound knowledge, but also his newfound balls. He'd walked right up to a dangerous monstrosity and poked at it. Examining the fibrous stuff he was talking about, I nodded.
"Looks like corn silk," I said. "Burnt corn silk. What kind of an alien is stuffed with that?"
We didn't have any answers. So I reported in that we'd encountered two aliens and killed them before they could fully enter the ship.
"Good work," Graves said. "But we have a problem. Not all the units were as successful as we were at repelling the boarders. Some have gotten through the secondary hull and are loose inside the ship. We're being recalled from this zone. I want all three platoons to withdraw back to the hatchways, retreat by squads, and prepare to enter Blue Deck itself. We're to search and destroy any invaders you find there."
"Are the bio people under attack, sir?"
Leeson asked on our shared unit channel.
"That's right. The enemy got through somehow. There are reported fatalities on Blue Deck. Our revival machines might be their target. This unit is to join the rest of our cohort and defend the revival machines at any cost. Graves out."
After relaying our new instructions and hustling back to the airlock, we piled inside. Everyone was grim-faced, and I could see sweat on their cheeks through their visors. Facing an unknown enemy in space is difficult.
The freaky possibilities work on a man's mind. The stars have produced countless variations of life, and a legionnaire never knew what form his next murderer might take. While the two hatches clanged and gases hissed past us in a gush, I had to wonder which squad had failed to hold the line in the rim zone. Had they been overwhelmed or just unlucky? I was glad it wasn't my team. So far, we hadn't suffered a single casualty. But beneath those thoughts lurked a new worry. The enemy seemed to know what they were doing. They'd tried to get into the engine core first and failed. Now they were going for Blue Deck. Could they be aware of the strategic value of our revival machines? If they got through and destroyed our equipment on Blue Deck, every death afterward would be a permanent one until we returned to Earth. If we returned at all. That thought alone was enough to make any legionnaire sweat. The bio people had always been paranoid about their technology. They were like jealous lovers who'd been cheated on a dozen times. They hid their secrets from everyone, even other members of their own legions. Accordingly, Blue Deck was a fortress. This region of the ship was all on one horizontal level, but it was more complex than that. It was built in concentric rings, each layer protected by thick walls and hatches that could keep any army at bay. When we got to the sealed inner region of Blue Deck proper, we were in for a shock. By that time, our entire unit had hooked up into a single force. We jogged down the passages to the main entrance, running in armor that clattered and boots that rang on the deck plates. The passages were wide here, 10 meters across or more, but the hatchways that led into Blue Deck's inner regions were even more imposing. They were huge, round portals with massive metal hinges and gears that looked like they belonged on a bank vault. The shock came when we reached the portal itself and saw it had been badly damaged. Sagging down and lying partially on the deck, I thought at first its hinges had been ripped loose by some kind of terrific force, possibly an explosion. But then I saw the hinges themselves and realized that the enemy had made good use of their excreted acids. They'd melted the hinges away and left the hatch lying askew. A pall of gray vapor writhed in the area, and I knew right off I didn't want to get a lungful of that. "Squad, double-check your visors," I ordered.
"Good idea, McGill," Graves said. "Unit halt. Secure visors. Harris, take your squad forward and secure that hatchway. Approach with caution."
Harris gave Graves a single sour glance. His lips were twisted up in an expression of resigned disgust. He wasn't a man that liked to go into chambers full of unknown aliens, or at least he didn't like to be the first in line. Despite his obvious opinion of his orders, he moved his people up gamely enough. Leapfrogging through the hatchway, each trooper took a defensive firing position and waved forward the man behind him. They were inside in seconds, sweeping the area.
"The immediate entrance is clear, sir,"
Harris reported back.
"Press on," Graves said. "Leeson, get the rest of your platoon in there to back him up."
Veteran Johnson and I were sent in next. Right about as I stepped over that smoking molten metal and onto Blue Deck proper, I began wishing I hadn't lost my dragon back on Earth. I'd have much preferred marching through this hatchway inside an armored vehicle with heavy weaponry. Once inside, Harris broke left, I broke right, and Johnson took his squad directly up the middle toward the next hatchway, which led deeper into Blue Deck. Leeson went with Johnson while Graves and the other two platoons hung back at the original hatch. Graves was playing it safe this time, I noted. Not just safe with his own skin, he'd never cared much about dying, but careful with the lives of his troops in general. I had to figure his caution was due to the fact the revival machines might be out of the game. Each loss could now be a permanent one, and he didn't want to lose more people because he'd rushed us into a trap. At first, we found nothing but corpses. Bio people lay on the decks in contorted positions. They were orderlies and specialists, mostly. They were in various states of death all along the gently curving inner passages.
"Looks like they put up a good fight," I said.
Veteran McGill? Keevy called. Come look at this.
I trotted to her position, and she showed me a smoking trail gouged in the deck. Looks like one of the invaders was wounded and dragged its acid-leaking body this way, I said. Ready for action, people?